Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ius Comune podcast. I'm Emilia Matais Ferrandiz from the International University of Catalonia in Barcelona. And here today, I am very happy to welcome Professor Peter Riedelberger from Bamberg University in Germany. He is an expert on history, concretely late antiquity, philology, and legal culture, currently professor for late history and culture at the University of Bamberg, and the principal investigator of the ERC project and COCO. Welcome, Professor Riedelberger. So to start with, can you provide an overview of the historical and legal context of the period you're studying in your current ERC project to help situate the listeners?
Yes, of course. But first of all, dear Emilia, thanks for the warm welcome. I'm really happy to be able to be here with you today. So the project is focused on the years between Constantine and Justinian, which is basically the main part of late antiquity. I mean, the historical context is well known, okay? It's the time when first the Roman Empire managed to recover after the disasters of the 3rd century, and then slowly started to get into trouble more so in the West than in the East. These limits I set, Constantine and Justinian, they're not random. With Constantine, a lot changes with respect for law, because he interferes with many things. So there's really a new chapter started, which you can also see as his reign is taken as starting limit by the Theodosian Code. And Justinian is a similar case because he is reforming many, many, many aspects of Roman law. So it really makes sense to make a break there.
Yeah. But to start us off, could you briefly introduce what the ANCOCO project is about and outline the main themes it explores, from the way imperial laws were composed and phrased to what are the challenges an editor of the Anna Bright's constitution has to face, and how they function as tools of communications in the late Roman Empire?
Yes, I have to start at a different point. Our main sources for these texts are the Theodosian Code and Justinian Code. Both of them large books, often published in several volumes. And this is what people know. And these volumes look seducively very much like modern law codes. You know, they are neat books, they are neat chapter titles. The texts are short, so it basically looks like sections in a modern law book. And this is why people think, they don't believe because they know better, but they feel that law is something similar in late antiquity, something they can grasp with their modern understanding. But actually, it's not. We all know that these small sections were excerpted from full constitutions. And we know some full constitutions very, very well, above all the novels, of course, and the Simondians, because both of these collections were published together with the Theodosian Code in Mommsen's edition. This is why everybody has it on their desk and they know it. And you can also see that most studies on the Theodosian Code restrict themselves to using these two collections, okay? This is what Matthews does in laying down the law, for example. However, actually, we have a three-figure number of such more or less full constitutions, which have been collected for the last time almost 200 years ago, in an extremely sloppy edition, okay? This is why very, very few people use them. I tried to do so exhaustively in my book. And when I did so, I was confronted with many problems, because often there are no good editions. You spend a lot of time hunting around for the good editions. There's no way to cite them in a serious way, because if the same text is transmitted in different sources, do you cite it by one or the other? You know, there's no integrated edition. And so I suggested a project to the European Research Council to collect all of these. They come from very different sources, okay? There are canonical collections, the inscriptions, there are a few papyri. they crop up in conciliar records. It's really it's a huge hunt. Okay, so to collect them and to give them their proper context. The proper context means, for example, the excerpts we have in the codes. They're really, really just tiny bits of the whole text. And the whole text can be surprisingly interesting, okay? You might find an emperor who regrets mistakes he made. You might find an emperor who tells people that they have to fear, and I repeat, fear an attack of vandals, and so on. So these introductions matter to them because they were much longer than the real legal ruling, and they were written explicit Latin. So it's one part of the project to understand the literary background of the creation. And another important part is to understand their communicative function, because we have quite a few sources that tell us what happened if such a new constitution arrived at a given place. Okay, so everybody rushed there to hear what is the will of the emperor. They listened like in a way that you could hear a needle drop and so on. So it was really, really important. I mean, that's a world without television, without newspapers, without anything. So the only kind of official news they get is these laws. And these laws, they're also used for all kinds of news, like announcing new emperors and so on. So not necessarily, legal in our sense. So you have to understand all of this to really, really grasp the context of these texts.
Yeah, so it's quite a big problem. I face that sometimes that, you read a paper and then you see people quoting pieces of the digest or the codex, and then you think like, well, this needs a bit of exegetical analysis because it has been interfered or abridged, as you said. And what you're doing is very interesting because it's also the mosaic and the widespread tradition. These are the current problems we have. So on the problems that the ancients face, finding the appropriate legislation to support your case in court at the time, and the task of the judges verifying the relevance and authenticity of legal sources. So we are talking here about forgery, that you have talked about this before, seems to have been a rather complex endeavor in late antiquity. Could you briefly describe the broader context of late antique codification for our listeners to give them a clearer idea of what are we talking about?
This is an extremely important point that is very, very often misunderstood, okay? So this is really, really important. There is no status at large in the Roman Empire, okay? There is no collection where you can look up the law in vigor. There's no such thing. There isn't. So it's just things you know in a way, okay? And the other thing is a judge is not presumed to know the law as he's presumed today, okay? Jura novit curia. That's not the case. So it was the responsibility of the court parties to present any legal ruling in their favor. You can compare this a little bit, okay, but really a little bit to the Americans, when they cite case at some court that happened in an obscure place like 30 years before, and the other side has no answer to this. But we are not talking about case law here. We are talking about official laws in vigor that might be forgotten. You have several indications of what that might mean in reality. You've got St. Augustine, who is a bishop, is also a judge. And one person wants to claim the children of another guy slaves, and Augustine is very reluctant to rule in his favor, but this person has a good lawyer and there are some constitutions, and so Augustine gets in touch with a friend who's a lawyer to find out if they are really relevant for the case and what he can do and so on. Okay. Another famous case is Pliny. This is 300 years earlier, with a rather similar case, and he has to check with Trajan that these people brought four constitutions, if these are really genuine, and Trajan can confirm one of them, which does not mean that the other three are fake. Just means he couldn't find them. Well, I mean, they can't be found in the archive being publicized. And that is the famous story in Ammianus makes fun of lawyers, that you can do whatever you want. You can even kill your own mother, because a good lawyer will always find some obscure law that permits that. Okay, so this is a terrible world, because you cannot really know what kind of law might be out there. Okay, and only only a good lawyer might find it. And then both sides might be surprised, not only the other side of the court, but even the judge himself, because he doesn't know the law either. So this is the context, and one can easily understand why everybody craved for a collection to get rid of this chaos.
Yeah. And I guess that they crave also to find good lawyers, are you saying, the lawyers that they are going to actually find the documents that can help you in your case. So it's very interesting how this thing plays there. But then how does this codification project, like Hermogenianus, Gregorianus, that we don't know, unfortunately, that much about, or later codifications of the Delosian Code, fit into this context? Did they really provide judges and litigants with some real help, some material to navigate their complexity of law?
Yes, certainly. But you have to look at the three texts you mentioned one by one, because they're quite different, actually. So the Gregorianus was the first such collection we know of. And given the huge popularity with which it was welcomed, I'm quite sure it was the first one, because if there had been any other good collection before, that people would have appreciated as much. And this Codex Gregorianus collects private rescripts, but only private rescripts, from Hadrian to his own time, which is basically, you know, Diocletian something. So we are talking about the last decade of the 3rd century, something like this. He collects what he gets, likely from earlier collections, which are not as exhaustive and, you know, limited in their scope. Why do I know this? If we don't know much about it and it's basically lost? Well, we do know that it was used for the Justinian Code, okay? So anything in the Justinian Code of that time should come from the Gregorian Code, and we also have a few other sources, okay? And we can see that the texts he used were from many different, originated in many, many different parts of the empire, because you get these posted remarks. This text was posted in whatsoever, okay? So the text was delivered by a courier. It was put out. And of course, it was the work of a good lawyer to immediately take down, not to steal it, but to make a copy of any posted text. Okay. And some lawyers might have had some minor collections. And what Gregorius, if his name was Gregorius, was that he collected all of these and made this comprehensive collection. Codex Hermogenianus is different. It's just 2 years, 293, 294, okay? And this guy very likely was a lawyer at the court. I mean, not a lawyer, a magister at the court, because we have a jurist of that name that appears in the digest. So this is quite probable. And the best hint we get is that in these texts, there's never a posted remark, okay? So Hermogenianus was in a different position. He was not using texts that were copied after they were posted, but he used texts at the source. So it's very different. But in only 2 years, but still a lot of texts. So this, I mean, because he was at the source, he had any text, okay?
Yeah.
But the other collection was rather random, what was there around.
Mm-hmm.
And Theodosianus, well, I guess we will speak about that more later on. But of course, first of all, the Theodosian Code did not invalidate these two, okay? These two still kept validity, that is clear. And otherwise, it was ordered that any constitution of the time of the idea that was in code could not be cited anymore. Okay. So any constitution that was issued between Constantine and, at any time before the publication of the code was considered invalid. You only could cite it from the Theodosian code. So its importance is overwhelming.
Mm, yeah, but it's quite like a big of mixture as well. But also what I'm wondering is like, these laws, as you kind of like have suggested before, these are very long. They are ornate. The language is sometimes very garbled and difficult to understand. You even have like a, we will talk about this later, but I see that you have like a new updated version of your digital humanities tool to for this kind of language. So how do these lawyers, how do they people grasp the meaning? Do they really were used to this sort of language? How do they, or maybe they are copying things and they're even copying the wrong things, like this broken telephone game, right? Like they don't understand it correctly and they maybe copy things that are not exact.
I mean, yes, it is like this, okay? I mentioned Augustine earlier when he writes to his lawyer friends and he writes, okay, they sent me a few constitutions. Some of them clearly do not belong here, so I sorted them out. Some I simply don't understand. And don't forget, okay, this guy was a professor of Latin in Milan, okay? And he's not talking about a complicated legal ruling, because you don't get these from the constitutions. It's just garbled language. There is a novel, I think it's by Martian. I might be wrong, but I think it's Martian. And it's about a Constantinian law. And he says, okay, this is totally ununderstandable. This is how I understand it. So everybody struggled with that. And there is this constitution by which Theodosian set the project of the Theodosian code in motion. And there he says that this cloud fork of that this hangs over the law should be lifted in clear language. I mean, in a way they do it, because they cut out most of this gibberish. However, any novel by Theodosius later is exactly the same as before. So they did not learn from it. Okay. It's like somebody who after years decides to tidy up their apartment, to clean everything, and then when everything is clean, walks in with dirty shoes and does not remove the shoes when putting the legs on the couch.
Yeah. Now, the phenomenon you mentioned, I don't know if it speaks about, well, on the one hand, of a big chaos, and then on the second hand, maybe could be understood as an opportunity for jurisprudence for being a bit creative, in the sense, as you said, I don't really understand what this means. I interpret it this way. Maybe another person who copies this interpreted in the other way. Will there be a discussion, or basically each lawyer will go to different tribunals and they will never even maybe match the court records, and there will be just different interpretation lying around all around?
Certainly, certainly. I mean, this is up to the people have to work on the text. And I mean, in my last intervention, I was quite negative. I can also give you the positive side, of course, because what I gave you like a minute ago is a modern view. I might give you the ancient view. And the ancient view would be very different. The ancient view is that this is the most appreciated way of prose at this time, okay? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know, antike Kunstprosa, okay? So this is how you think. You create the most elegant kind of language you can create. Okay. Mm. I mean, of course, it's an abomination for a lover of Cicero. It's an abomination for a lover of Tacitus. Okay. But, but I mean, if you like ancient sculpture or if you like modern art, you will think that Baroque is, you can't stand it. Okay. But there are people who really like Baroque. They changed any church in Germany to Baroque. Tastes are different. So this is what they believed was the most elegant way to cast language in. And you will also notice that the ghost writers of constitutions, okay, so the Quaestores, they're usually literary guys. You know, Ausonius, the poet of Mosella, he did that for quite a while, okay?
Yeah.
And so they were basically chosen for the literary skill, not for the legal skills.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot to do, let me finish that, with the communicative function I mentioned earlier, okay?
Mm.
The laws did not go to some specialists, some jurists. I mean, laws today, they're just written by jurists for jurists. It's mm-hmm. technical. It's really technical. That's not, it's the main broadcast of the Roman
yeah.
Empire.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Because it's the people who need to suit for themselves, as you say, and for the courts. And I guess it's a way also of showing authority, right? You use this kind of like Baroque language in order to show you cannot be, you're the emperor, right? You need to be a bit ornate in that way.
Of course.
Yeah. So, but when you read these constitutions, then they are so detailed that even small technical features like dating formulas or subscriptions and the end of laws carry a lot of information, as you have defended in in some of your later publications. Can you give us an example of one of these and how then paying close attention to these details help us better understand the context, provenance, and circulation of law at this time?
I mean, I already gave an example with the difference of Gregorianus and Hermogenianus, okay? And you can use that also for establishing the provenance of the constitutions used for the Theodosian Code. So you will see that the latest constitutions, those issued only a few years before it was put together, those were issued in the East. They certainly came from the archives, okay? They are always sent, but they are never received. So the copy, the master copy from which they were copied, they were accepted, were not received, it was just sent out. Okay, so we certainly used Oriental archives. While the situation is absolutely different for Constantinian laws are quite random, okay? So sometimes they are posted at places far apart. Sometimes, okay, it's also to be the recipient. You can see that these uniform laws, the last ones, they always go to the Praetorian prefect of the East. So this was basically the copy collection they used. While the Constantinian law, they go to anybody, okay? Really to anybody. So they certainly used for Constantine earlier collections,
mm-hmm.
which is also quite strange if you think about it. You have the official commission to put together the official collection,
mm-hmm.
and still they have to rely on apparently private collections. And this is also why they have in their task, really one point, and this is, please check exactly for forgeries.
Yeah, exactly. And one wonders, the authors of these compilations, will they do it for practical reasons to help themselves, for the sake of being, you know, kind to everybody and furnish a tool, or maybe also for vanitas in a way as well, to have the glory? Well, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, the only thing is not among these, but others that were posted in Beirut, you know, famous law school. So one could think they were copied in that context. So, but anything else is just speculation.
Speculation, yes, of course. Going back to the Theodosian Code again. So from your work, we understand that Theodosius initiated a codification project that was only fully realized later under Justinian. Could you give us some context for this to help us better understand the Theodosian Code and its limitations, if we can call it in this way?
Yes. So you remember, you have this huge chaos of texts. And where do you start? Where should you start? And the plan that Theodosius devised for that was actually quite clever. He said, let's do it step by step. The first step will be to collect any constitution between Constantine and Justinian, between Constantine and my time, and with discarding everything we have to discard. So we discard, of course, fakes, forged constitutions. We discard constitutions by emperors we consider illegitimate, like Magnus Maximus, for example. Then we remove anything that is not a legal ruling, these ornate introductions and endings. And then, that's my addition, we put these on strips of paper, okay? And if one constitution considers more than one matter, we use more than one slip of paper, okay? Mm-hmm. And after we have a huge heap of slips of paper, we think about a basic structure. So the basic structure was 16 books at the end. Like, I mean, book 16 is religion. And for example, 16.5 is on heretics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 16.2 is on clerics, for example, okay? So now when we have our structure, we can sort out our texts. And then we have a first product, which is an unnamed code, okay? It's just a collection of the material, it's not more, no? And it says for our unnamed code, we keep there even any constitution that is revoked later. Anything that is changed later, we keep it there, okay?
Yeah.
And then, so this was the original plan, okay? The original plan, the plan that never was fully put into reality. We will tidy up. So throw out everything that is revoked later and check for any contradictions, remove any contradictions. And then we will sort into our titles. Also, all the texts of the legal scientists mm-hmm. who lived, of course, earlier, 3rd century or earlier, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And only this final code will be called Theodosian code. So this Theodosian code is actually more than Justinian gave us, because Justinian kept the digest and the code apart.
Yeah.
So if you want to find something on a given subject, you have to check both. Theodosius wants to integrate that. But it never worked out. So several years later, he gave up. It doesn't say it so clearly, but it's really, really evident.
Okay, I didn't know that. That was the feeling.
Yes, and he issued a second constitution with a few changes. The most important one is that he gave up the whole project. So anything he wanted was this collection of the material. And in the first step, he didn't allow them to change the text, just to cut. Okay.
No.
But in the second, he gave up on that too. He said, please don't change any content, but if it makes it clearer, if it makes it shorter, you may change a little bit, but not more. Okay. You can call that final product the Theodosian code because he gave up on the, yes. And what Justinian did, 100 years later, more or less, was removing any contradictions and discarding anything that was outdated. He integrated the Gregorian code and the Hermogenian code, at least that. And so it was, and of course he updated it with newly issued constitutions up to his time. So here you have got this consistent code. What he did not do was integrate the legal writers. They got separately in the digests. I mean, the difference between the two is, of course, enormous, okay? Because as a historian, I love very much the Theodosian code.
Mm-hmm. Can I imagine?
I miss a lot of text, of course. I would like to have a lot more, but at least I can be arguably sure that we get the situation of this time. It's very, very different for the Justinian code.
Mm. Yeah, but then for what you have described, I mean, some of the problem on, you know, reading the Theodosian code or reinterpreting it is like some people thought, okay, we're going to make parallels on constitutions that are kind of coincident in the Theodosian and the Justinian, and then we will find the match. But then this match is not possible because one had considerable cuts, the other was even more had more cuts, and then as you said, it has been like they remove contradiction as well, they remove more stuff. So then it's not possible to make a match there. That's why the solution will be in what you're doing actually, right? Like going to more primary sources, like manuscripts, papyri, inscriptions, etc.
Well, Well, I mean, it's quite easy to compare Theodosian code and Justinian code, because any constitution of the time of the Theodosian code in the Justinian code comes from the Theodosian code. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We know of no counterexample. So if the original is not lost in the Theodosian code, because the Theodosian code as we have it is not complete, most of the cases we can assign a Theodosian code number to a Justinian code number. But of course, the changes, the modifications in the Justinian code are of interest only if you're interested in the 6th century, okay? There's nothing that betrays a lack of knowledge on these sources more than if people explain Theodosian code constitution by the Justinian version.
Yeah.
It's clear in the Justinian codes, in fact, it shows they have no idea what they're talking about.
And to go back a little bit on the bare bones on, you know, ornate language, sometimes some scholars have described late antique laws as very symbolic, like more derived to projecting imperial authority than as shaping daily life. But in your book Prolegomena, you argue the opposite, that sanctions had very real social and legal consequences. So, but still, they still have this verbose, imprecise, and often repetitive language, even after the Theodosian Code. So what does this tension reveal about the role and character of imperial law then in late antiquity?
I mean, I've never seen any good argument for this symbolic interpretation, okay? It's basically anthropological point of view. Whatever I don't understand is symbolic. But it's not like this. It's obviously mostly it's based on a lack of knowledge of non-juristic sources. Okay, they simply work on the codes. They've never seen anything else, and then they delve into their fantasies. But if you read lots of late antique texts, you will feel the real life consequences of these laws. And this is what I try to do in my book, giving many examples where we can really see what happens, people who are condemned according to laws we know, and so on.
No, I mean, make total sense. The only thing is, like, will be, as you said, if the language is verbose, then maybe it's not exactly the same interpretation in every case. It differs a little bit by different courts. But I would like to move a little bit further in time to talk about the editors, Mommsen and Kruger. So thank you very much for your article, I have to say, because I have enjoyed a lot reading the small hints of the personalities of both authors that, you know, I only know them by their writing. So seeing them as humans with their defects has made them closer to me, actually. And your article on Theodor Mommsen and Paul Kruger revisits the story of how the Theodosian Code was edited in the 19th and 20th century. Could you explain what was the real disagreement between Mommsen and Kruger, and why earlier scholarship sometimes misrepresented it as a case of Mommsen kind of stealing the work of Kruger?
So what happened? These men were the most important editors of law sources at this time, okay? No question about this. They were of different generations. So Mommsen was a generation older than Kruger. As a young scholar, Kruger had a scholarship to collect the manuscripts for the Justinian Code, what he did. And he also collected during this time information on the manuscripts of the Theodosian Code. And he promised for 30 years to do this edition, but he didn't. So finally, when Mommsen had completed his penal law, he wrote to Kruger and said, okay, look, I'm out of work now. Being about a guy in the 80s, okay? And he felt bored, and he would like to do the Theodosian Code. How far did you get so far? I mean, just a postcard, totally innocent. And Kruger wrote back, is actually quite far, blah, blah, blah. Only a few bits are missing. And Mommsen wrote back, fantastic, so let's do this together. And Kruger apparently was rather happy about this idea at the start, because this means he had something, one millstone less around his neck, okay, some big amount of work he got rid of, but still his name would be on the book, you know, Mommsen and Krüger evolving code, fantastic. But when Mommsen got deeper into the text and the project, he understood that the whole work of Krüger was useless. At the start, their communication was quite okay. Mommsen always told Krüger what he's doing right now, because that's what he promised. He said, I'll keep you informed and blah, blah, blah. But he always answered rather shortly. And if asked for help, he provided this help, but not much, okay? And so after some time, Mommsen gave up. He simply didn't give him updates anymore. And Mommsen rechecked all the manuscripts Krüger had checked. Okay. So the work that Krüger had done as a young person was redone. There are very few exceptions, but these exceptions hardly count, because one item, very important item, is a lost manuscript that burnt, unfortunately. One really important manuscript. But Krüger had published a full apographum, it's not a copy, but a handmade copy of it. So this thing was published. Okay, so anybody could use it. You could look it up in the library. So I think just one manuscript. It's not a manuscript, it's just a few pages. There can also see how fragmentary our sources are for putting this collection together. This is what Mommsen used of Krüger's work. But that was not unique. Mommsen used many people who checked manuscript for him elsewhere. He sent them there and they did the work and relied on that. So it's nothing special. So Mommsen finally asked Krüger, so now the work is done. I can't put your name as co-editor on the title, because this would not be true. And I'm sure you wouldn't want this either. I really don't know what to put there. So you tell me what I should put there. And then Krüger was really unhappy. And I mean, he was a difficult person anyway. And he wrote a strange letter that, if I had known, blah, 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 anyway. But what he suggests in the end is Theodor Mommsen edited it using the preparatory work of Krüger.
Mm, yeah. And but as you describe, it doesn't seem that unusual. Like, even, you need, you're doing such work so fast as Mommsen was doing, you actually need people to do a bit of the work, and then you compile and you nuance exactly. And make everything.
And if you sit 30 years on the text, you really, really have no right whatsoever to complain that you didn't finish it. Sorry. It's sorry. And the whole misunderstanding is actually based on a lack of understanding of German and Latin. I don't want to tell names.
Yeah.
But I mean, preparation in Latin is apparatus, okay?
Yeah.
And adsumptu apparatum means using the preparation. And one famous scholar translated it as using the apparatus.
Okay.
Oh, it's a very famous scholar. Yeah, very famous scholar. So using the apparatus. And so he wrote that Mommsen appropriated the apparatus of Krüger and published it under his own name. And that Krüger was so sad because his work was stolen by Mommsen. No, he was sad because Mommsen went into his sphere. He believed that this was his business, the Athosian Code, even if he didn't work on it for 30 years. And and then he was unhappy that Mommsen did not like his work. So these are the real problems. But it's mostly based on. I mean, you get a few examples of that in my article. And there are several people who wrote on that matter who really don't understand enough German and Latin. There's a few examples of that, and it's not good.
Yeah. But also what you highlight is that, okay, Krüger's method of reconstructing the code was problematic. It was not as good as Mommsen, but his textual criticisms could be very sharp. Did also was of help of Mommsen. Did he use that when he reconstructed the Theodosian code?
Not enough. This is my main criticism of Mommsen. So Mommsen rechecked the manuscripts. And usually he did quite fine, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there are a few that are really, really problematic. There is one manuscript that burnt at one time, and they quenched the fire with water, so you have a fire and water damage at the margin. And so it's not good. And I personally have more faith in the readings of Krüger here than in Mommsen's. Because, I mean, Krüger was a lot younger. I think he was late 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Mommsen was in his 80s, and he really had eye problems at this time. And Krüger was very pedantic. He was super pedantic. Mommsen was very, very quick. I mean, Mommsen was a genius, but really quick. Okay. So this is...
Yeah.
So here, I really, one would like to see a manuscript oneself, okay, of course. But yeah, and the other thing is a few of the completions, integrations of Mommsen are certainly wrong, while Krüger suggests the right thing. And this I can prove because Mommsen did not have any regard for the prose rhythm. I think we'll get to this later, but Paul Maas wrote to him, you have to take this into account, and Mommsen wrote back, okay, I understand it, now I know it, but I can't do that. But
But yeah. Do you think that also in the way of Mommsen was rendering the manuscripts was influenced by his own conception of a state, or is just because he was not reading it okay, interpreting it okay? I mean it because... I mean, as I normally study Roman economy, for example, many of the interpretations of Mommsen were very Stadtrecht, so very based on the Prussian state that he knew. I don't know if in the Theodosian code this could have had an influence when he read the manuscripts. No, it's not that.
No. We're talking about small things, okay?
But that can change a lot anyway.
Not huge things. It's not these kinds of problems.
But Krüger, in any way, as you're saying, he was very sharp, very pedantic or whatever, but very sharp as well. In a separate note, I have to say I enjoyed also the note in your article when you said that Mommsen writes to him saying, how are they going to share the profits of the edition? And you said something like, well, there was a time where classicists actually make profits of their work, something that
is
unlikely to happen today. Yeah, now nobody could think about this at all. Yeah, I would like then to finish this section about talking about something that I find very fascinating about your work. I think I will not dare to say that you're a IT aficionado. I think with what you have created, I think you're an expert on digital tools now. So, and by the way, thank you very much for the amanuensis. It has been of great work. And thanks for creating an app, because it's really good when I'm in conference and I can have my app and quote and check the text to respond to people. I'm sure that many of our listeners will feel this way. But then, so alongside your historical research on all these constitutions and codes, your projects have also produced digital tools like amanuensis, TTVilus, and now Cursor, that if I'm not wrong, there's a new version up very recently.
Yes.
Could you introduce these tools to our listeners for the ones that they don't know them and explain what role they play in advancing the study of ancient legal texts?
Okay, so amanuensis was published more than 10 years ago. I think it's now a staple among legal historians working on Roman texts. It gives you a very fast and, I believe, very convenient interface to search in the database of Roman texts, which was originally created by Mena, Romtext, Austria 60s. And classicists happily used it until the coming of Windows 7, I think, because then the software they provided with it did not work anymore because it was DOS-based. And that was the moment when we created amanuensis. And as all of these texts are out of copyright anyway, and everyone was super, super nice, really super nice, okay, we could integrate them. So you can basically search for any Latin legal text of antiquity, excepting contracts. There are no papyri, there are no contracts of that type. And we added many things in the years. So now even the Greek novels are there. You can search for Greek and Latin at the same time, something you can't do with any other website I know. So it's not possible with the TLG or Prepos or something. So yeah, so basically fast and convenient searches in legal texts. TTVLOOKUP is very easy to explain. This simply adds autocorrect for Latin and ancient Greek to Microsoft Word on Microsoft Windows. Okay, it's very convenient. You simply mark your text, change the language, not to Latin and Greek, but different, but you always need to read the instructions, and then any mistake is underlined. Whenever I have to review a book with typos in the Latin and Greek, I really get unhappy because I could have used TTVLOOKUP free. Okay.
Yeah. I can understand that. I will use it for the next time I write something like that. I will not have any problems. But Cursor is the one that is more specific to what you're actually doing now.
Cursor is quite complicated to explain. So the constitutions are using the most advanced prose rhythm of any text in antiquity, okay? Late antique texts often use the cursor system, you know, like Ammianus, Tarlus, Plinus, Lanus, Velox, Tarlus, Velox. And this is just based on the stress. We all know from school that in classical Latin, we had this system that was based on heavy and light syllables, or long and short, as they are often confusingly called, which is quite different, of course, that system. And the Cursus Mixtus of late antiquity and the constitutions combines both systems, which means you expect a cursus, but not with any, but the syllables, it's not random whether they are heavy or light. So there are much preferred patterns of heavy and light syllables. Mm-hmm. There's been done marvelous research by two Americans quite a while ago. They have provided fantastic statistics. And based on that, we could assign frequencies to different patterns, or clausulae, if you prefer. And so Cursor works like this. You copy-paste your text into it. It should be a late antique constitution or something accepted from a late antique constitution, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Then
you click on the preparation button, and the preparation button, you get hopefully the right quantity for each vowel. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, this cannot always work, because, you know, there's populus and populus. And liber and liber, and you all know many such cases. So that's a problem. And there's also, of course, the problem of grammar.
Yeah.
It could be amicitia or amicitia, or ablative, nominative, and so on. But, I mean, grammar is a little bit easier to handle, because you don't need AI for that. You have a few tricks to understand. But okay, so quantities are assigned, and it's actually not that bad. But usually it should be basically okay. But you are still invited to recheck all the quantities, whether it's what is suggested, this is good.
Yeah.
And once you have done that, you click on the analysis button, and then you get a heat map. If it's dark green, it's fantastic. You've got a cursus with a much preferred pattern. If it's light green, you've got a cursus with a pattern that is okay, that is reasonably frequent. If it's yellow, it means you've got a cursus,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have any established pattern.
Yeah.
And red means no cursus.
Yeah.
So why do we do this? As I told you, there is no kind of type of text in late antiquity with a stricter prose rhythm. Okay. So if I feed my constitution into it, and it's dark green, I can be happy. If there is red, I must be alarmed. It's quite likely that there's a mistake in the transmitted text.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe if it's taken from the Theodosian code, maybe they made a cut at this point, you know, because they did not care for the prose rhythm in the compilation. They ignored that. So, and of course, you expect the cursus only at the end of a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to have it at different places too. They often have it, but it's mandatory at the end. And if you're at the end of a sentence and there's no cursus and it comes from the Theodosian code, they might have made a cut there.
Yeah.
And removed something like, you know, something that moved on. But if it's a full constitution that is transmitted in a totally different way, on an inscription, you know, on stone, in a collection and so on, you might start to think there's a problem. I mean, the other day I was translating a constitution from the Collectio Avellana, and there was one sentence I really could not make any sense of. I checked the translations, and they seemed as clueless as I was. I checked the apparatus, but there was no indication whatsoever. I thought, okay, either I'm stupid, or they did not see my problem. And of course, then you put it into a cursor, and you can see that all the sentences around have wonderful rhythm. Okay, so everything is dark green, and this one is red, deep red.
Yeah. So that sentence could have been an interpolation then, or
sorry,
that sentence will have been an interpolation, or what do you think now?
It could be anything. It could be a lacuna.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is the most likely thing. I think there's something missing, because there's no easy way to establish a rhythm here. So I think they skipped a line or something like this.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're giving a lot of material to future articles for future researchers, because you can put, and if you have read, actually it's an opportunity to check what is wrong here, right? Like with the problems, we get more research done. So, okay, you have done obviously a lot of research to be able to do this digital tool. So is there anything you are working now that you would like to mention, that, you know, what goes beyond these digital tools? I know that, I think ANCOCO is finishing by the end of this year, or maybe it's next year.
No.
I think
by end of April next year. So basically something like half a year, and so we are really, really busy with the edition. I mean, that is the main piece, and it's a hell lot of work. So yeah, this is what I'm working on now.
Yeah. There's always that. That's the minute. So just to finish, because I have still enough of your time, thank you very much. Where can we follow the ongoing work and results of your ERC project and COCO?
Best on my website, www.rielberger.de. There you can also find the links to the free tools.
Okay, perfect. So again, thank you very much, Peter, for this time. Thank you very much for enlightening us so much about the world of the Code Theodosianus and Mommsen and Kruger, etc. And thank you very much again for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Have a great day. Bye.
You too. Bye.
Thank you.